They still are, I assured her, having seen her recently when I went to interview him at his ranch. She's got a terrific figure, and the two of them seem very happy together. Hepburn recalled McRae saying that he always wanted to be a rancher, and that he was using his acting just to get there, and it's funny, because I really think he was the most underrated actor of his day. He could do everything. Look at him in that Hitchcock thing, foreign correspondent, and then in The Most Dangerous Game, and all those comedies, the George Stevens picture, the more the merrier, and the Preston Sturges pictures, Sullivan's Travels and the Palm Beach story, and he looked great on a horse. But the problem, and this was one of those words she made all her own, landing on each syllable with equal emphasis, was he never really had a studio behind him, nobody to present him, to develop him. And that was so important in those early days. With the big studios grooming big stars, you needed that kind of push. That's what Gable had and Crawford. They weren't great actors, but they were great personalities, and the big studios got completely behind them. Now, who were the big male stars today, she asked me. Pacino, Hoffman, De Niro, Stallone. Exactly, she interrupted. That's the problem. Now, those old boys, Gable and Cooper and Jimmy and Bogey and Spence, well, they looked good riding a horse or in white tie and tails. Now, who can you name today who can do that? Who else have you seen? Kate would ask whenever there was a lull in conversation. There was always a trace of yearning in her voice. I felt she wanted to know not just whom I was seeing, but which of her contemporaries was still alive and working. She enjoyed providing thumbnail sketches, bits of background for the book, which I always found enlightening and entertaining. Joel put me on to Barbara Stanwyck, I said. Well, they really had the same problem, didn't they? I mean, she was a freelance actor, a kind of gun for hire, and in the beginning didn't really have the backing of a big studio. I mean, she had a broad range of things she could do, not the classics, but certainly heavy drama and light comedy. She could make you laugh and she could make you cry. Chaplin, of course, could make you do both at the same time. Garbo forever remained Hepburn's favorite movie star. I think she was a great actress, but even more than that, she carried so much mystery with her. From the moment she walked on the screen, you simply couldn't take your eyes off her. You wanted to know everything about her, and you knew she wasn't going to give it to you. That's a movie star. And that's what we all wanted to be, she said of the thousands of girls who took trains and buses to Hollywood to be discovered. In the spring of 1934, Katharine Hepburn returned to Hollywood. She was, for that moment at least, a star with a 6-picture contract with RKO, then considered the liveliest studio in town. The most minor of the major studios, RKO prided itself on low budgets, fresh talent, and original material, coming up with such recent hits as Little Women and King Kong, and the early Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers musicals. Fred gave Ginger class, Ginger gave Fred sex appeal, Hepburn famously observed. She was also returning to Leland Hayward, her beau, her word, one of the most dashing men in town. Her theatrical experience with Jed Harris only doubled the intensity with which she reapproached her work on the screen. Hepburn was back with a vengeance, which unfortunately occasionally showed. In an attempt to replicate her triumph in Little Women, RKO promptly cast Hepburn in The Little Minister. Like the former film, this was based on a 19th-century literary favorite, a novel and play by Sir James M. Barrie. With the notable exception of Richard Wallace, a journeyman director standing in for George Cukor, most of the former crew members reassembled to craft this project. As before, the Heermans produced the final draft of the screenplay, the love story of Lady Babby, who often escaped from her guardian's manor house dressed as a gypsy, so that she could walk among the struggling weavers of the Auld Licht Kirk in Scotland, only to fall in love with the Kirk's new minister. The film was a mild success, not as big as the studio had hoped or expected, or, as Hepburn said, it should have been. She believed George Cukor's presence might have made a great difference, but he had been involved in the making of a genuine classic that year, David Copperfield. The star herself ultimately took the blame for the little minister's failure, largely because, she later admitted, she hadn't really wanted the part in the first place. The main reason I did it, she confessed, was that I had heard that Ginger Rogers really wanted to play it, and I knew the studio wanted me more and that I could do it better. What an ignoble reason. I'm still quite disgusted with myself. Still, she believed a strong director would have curbed what she called a rather fancy performance. Looking back, she said, I thought I had discovered what magnificent hands I had, and I remember that they became the most important part of my performance, most peculiar. Viewing the film today, one sees the accuracy of Hepburn's memory. In almost every scene, her hands appear self-consciously folded or clasped or flapping or floating. Beyond that distraction, the part calls for whimsy, an almost otherworldly elfin quality. And Hepburn admitted, I think I'm probably just too down-to-earth for that. Adopting a Scottish burr, which came and went from scene to scene, forced her voice into its highest registers, often proving irritating for both the actress and her audience. She proceeded immediately to her next picture, a deservedly forgotten modern romance called Break of Hearts. It was intended as another vehicle for Hepburn and John Barrymore. She is an aspiring composer, he is an alcoholic conductor. This time, however, she would have the star billing. But Barrymore turned down the sentimental melodrama, and it fell to Charles Boyer, one of the few French actors to achieve leading man status in American films, and one of Hollywood's great lovers, on screen and off. Rumors immediately spread that she and Boyer were intimately involved. Kate later denied them, insisting that it was not for her lack of trying. She called the film, which garnered her worst reviews to date and fared poorly at the box office, a mistake, one she explained away by saying, I felt I was sitting out there in Hollywood, and my career was such that if I wasn't moving ahead, I was falling behind. And so I did the picture out of a kind of desperation, never a wise move. Just as she was about to overstay her welcome with the public, one of the most appealing screen roles ever written came her way. While she was finishing Break of Hearts, RKO was adapting Booth Tarkington's Alice Adams, which had already been a successful silent film. The eponymous heroine, a socially ambitious, middle-class girl in the Midwest, who falls for a handsome man above her station, was, in Hepburn's words, a big plum, a sweet and juicy role. I had read Tarkington growing up and always thought he was a wonderful writer, a great social observer with a lot of heart, and I thought the script captured Alice's desperation to be more than she was or than she could be. She was in a race that she couldn't win, and of course that's great fun to play because she doesn't know it's hopeless and the audience does. So the harder Alice works at it, the more heartbreaking she becomes. What appealed to Hepburn most about the part, and what she believed she could bring to the role more than any of her competition in Hollywood, was the gentle humor. To ensure its place in the film, she insisted on a director with a comic bent. The studio was about to sign William Wyler, a promising young man just coming into his own as Samuel Goldwyn's prize director, primarily of social dramas. But Hepburn had reservations and kept stalling. Then her friend Eddie Killey, who had served as assistant director on practically all of her RKO pictures, recommended a young director named George Stevens. He had broken in under Hal Roach, the king of two-reel comedies, and had recently directed an episode in a popular comedy series featuring two different families, the Coens and the Kellys. Hepburn asked to meet him. I thought he was a really odd duck, she said of Stevens, a big man with a weathered face and an aloof air. He hardly spoke, and at first I wasn't sure if he was just plain dumb or so smart that he was busy analyzing everybody else. Whether or not to let him direct Alice Adams virtually came down to the toss of a coin. Producer Pan Berman flipped a quarter, and when it came up heads, Wyler, he and Hepburn looked at each other. He asked if they should flip again, and Hepburn said yes. I just felt George was strong and fun. We signed him up mostly on my hunch, I would say which, in this case, proved to be very good. Her hunch was not entirely professional. Although she still told herself that her future with Leland Hayward was advancing, possibly toward the altar, she still found herself attracted to a growing number of men, especially directors. The inherent drama between the man calling the shots and the woman who had to perform created a sexual tension that most people never thought existed on the sets of Katharine Hepburn movies. But during the course of shooting Alice Adams, it became apparent to those around them that Stevens and Hepburn were having an affair. It was an intense love match, real emotional duels as opposed to the more jocular jousting on George Cukor sets. "We were both incredibly strong-willed," Kate said of her first picture with George Stevens. "I seemed to have the upper hand because I was the bigger star, and I had been largely responsible for his being hired. But George had the upper hand because he was, after all, the director, and a very tough director at that. He would not budge, and he made us do one scene, with her handsome, easygoing leading man, Fred McMurray, close to 80 times." For Stevens, these battles were more than simple lovers' quarrels. "Now, George Stevens was really a brilliant director," Kate averred many times, "and this was not just some personal conquest on his part. I think he felt he really had something to offer me. I had had some success, but I was still pretty new to the movie game, and he believed he could direct me to become better, not necessarily different than I had been, but somehow more than I had been." That was never more evident than in one of the film's most famous scenes. Alice has just returned from a society dance, which proved to be a series of slights and humiliations for her from start to finish. Throughout the night, she has maintained her pluck and dignity. Only after she returns from the party in the rain, raps on her parents' door to let them know she's home, and goes into her own bedroom, does she allow herself to cry. In playing the scene, Hepburn intended to throw herself onto her bed and sob into her pillow. Stevens had what he thought was a better idea. Using one of his trademark shots, a huge screen-filling close-up, he thought Alice should walk to the window and look out into the rain so that the drops running down the pane would accentuate the tears running down her cheeks. Hepburn liked the idea, but when she had to perform the scene, the tears would not flow. She claimed at the time that cold water had dripped through the leaky set window and frozen her up. She attempted the scene repeatedly, but to no avail. Then, instead of admitting that she was having a technical acting problem, she insisted the problem was in the staging, that throwing herself on the bed was not only the way she had envisioned playing the scene, but that it was truer to Alice's character, that Alice would stifle her crying. Director and actress crossed swords. He insisted that Alice could not possibly keep herself from crying in the scene, that the one who would stifle her tears was Katharine Hepburn. At last, her illogic fractured his normally calm facade, and he flew into a rage, the sheer force of which terrified her into playing the scene one more time, at the window with tears flowing. "It's a wonderful moment," Kate recalled half a century later, "but it occurred only because I thought he was going to kill me." Alice Adams became a big hit and one of Hepburn's personal favorites. Both she and the picture were nominated for Academy Awards. Mutiny on the Bounty won Best Picture that year, and Bette Davis was named Best Actress for Dangerous. More important, appearing in practically every scene in Alice Adams, this successful, critically acclaimed film seemed to ensure Hepburn's place in the public's heart and her position as a star. Feeling the rush himself, RKO producer Pandro Berman told her she had only to name her next project. Hepburn's pal, George Cukor, coming off three consecutive blockbuster hits, had become infatuated with a novel of Compton Mackenzie called The Early Life and Adventures of Sylvia Scarlett. It was a peculiar, picaresque story about a girl who masquerades as a boy so that she can accompany her father, a crook, on the lam. In their travels, they meet up with an odd lot of characters, including a Cockney rogue. Hepburn thought it was a brilliant book, but she never really saw its cinematic possibilities. Cukor had enough enthusiasm for the two. Full of themselves, they told Pandro Berman this was the project they wanted to work on next. The producer could hardly deny them. The story, with its androgynous sexual interplay, was unlike anything else on the screen, and it was another showy part for Hepburn, for which her hair was cut like a boy's. But as she later admitted, just because something is different doesn't necessarily mean it's good. She felt only one member of the cast really made something of his role, and that was the young actor who played the Cockney, Cary Grant. The former Archibald Leach had, in fact, already appeared in some 20 films in his first 3 years in Hollywood, but he still had not fully developed his screen persona yet. He was handsome, but slightly pudgy in this picture, and instead of the clipped English tones for which he would become famous and widely mimicked, he spoke flawless Cockney, which was, in fact, more akin to his mother tongue. Hepburn had never had so much fun on a movie set with an actor. and she became fast friends with this former acrobatic dancer from Bristol, England, who had the know-how to parlay his charm and looks into respectability. Indeed, he would soon become a 20th-century icon of suavity and breeding. Sylvia Scarlett was, in the star's opinion, awful. Even before the film opened, all involved knew they had a big flop on their hands. After a preview in nearby Huntington Park, Pan Berman came to George Cukor's house to commiserate with his director and star. They urged him to forget about this film, assuring him that they would both do another for him for free. "Please," said Berman, "don't bother." Although they remained bosom buddies, Hepburn steered clear of George Cukor for a while, at least professionally. She made her next three pictures with more rough-and-tumble directors, none of whom, as it happened, was especially happily married. John Ford, one of Hollywood's most brilliant filmmakers, who had just taken the town by storm with The Informer, was hired to direct Mary of Scotland, a successful Maxwell Anderson play, which had starred Helen Hayes on Broadway, about the Stuart heir trying to claim the throne of England from Elizabeth I. Again, Hepburn was not crazy about her part, the title role. "I thought she was an ass," she said, "and I would have rather played Elizabeth, who, after all, was the powerful one." But she knew it was a great vehicle for a star, and she welcomed the opportunity to work with Jack Ford, whom she had known slightly over the past few years. Frederick March, one of Hollywood's most versatile leading men, played her husband and protector, the Earl of Bothwell. James Hepburn, who was in fact a distant ancestor. It proved difficult to cast the antagonist of the play, Elizabeth. Bette Davis wanted the role, but Warner Brothers made a practice of never loaning her out. She would limn her own indelible version of the formidable monarch for the studio just 3 years later. Even Ginger Rogers, forever trying to prove to her studio bosses that she could play serious drama, threw her hat into the ring. "Can you imagine," Kate said one night, striking a pose of shock, "the Virgin Queen?" At one point, Hepburn, whom some wags in town had by then dubbed Catherine of Arrogance, suggested that she play both roles. "But if you play both queens," asked John Carradine, a favorite Ford player who had a supporting role in the film, "how would you know which one to upstage?" Hepburn found nothing amusing about the comment at the time. Years later, she roared with laughter telling it. Long before shooting finished, Ford lost interest in the project. The sets, staging, and photography were unusually good, but he offered no support in fleshing out the characters, all but reducing the actors, including March's real wife, Florence Eldridge, as Elizabeth, to pageanteers. One day Ford walked off the set in despair and told Hepburn to direct the scene herself. Said Kate of the final product, "It laid a great big egg." But Ford, born Sean Aloysius O'Feeney, never lost interest in his leading lady, a big, red-haired, melancholy Irishman who had problems with his wife and with the bottle. He loved nothing more than getting out to sea on his ketch, the Erinner, usually with some salty chums and some fun-loving young women and plenty of booze. He found Katharine Hepburn even more intoxicating. When he wasn't lording over her on the set, he privately allowed himself to turn submissive, succumbing to her energy, excitement, and enthusiasm for life. She called him Sean and found him a slightly tragic figure, full of demons, which he seemed to elude on the water. She often went out on the Erinner with him, although he generally concluded each picture with a long, drunken voyage somewhere. After shooting Mary of Scotland, he hied off with Kate on a healthier retreat to Fenwick. A romance ripened. Hepburn followed Mary of Scotland, a flop, with A Woman Rebels, a Victorian costume drama in which her character defies the conventions of her class by having a child out of wedlock and editing a progressive woman's magazine. Mark Sandrich, who had been directing Astaire and Rogers musicals, proved unusually clumsy in this particular outing. "The film ended up a mistake," said Hepburn, "a complete error on everyone's part, mostly mine for doing it in the first place." She followed that with A Disaster, another attempt at recovering some of the charm of Little Women, a second Barry play called Quality Street. Under George Stevens's a-characteristic direction, it also proved to be a labored attempt at whimsy, to nobody's credit. "That made four skunks in a row," Hepburn recounted, "and I felt I had to get out of town for a while." It was not just her recent track record that sent her running. Thinking she had the best of both worlds, living with one man yet having occasional love affairs with others, Hepburn realized she had been living in a fool's paradise. You might say I lived like a man, Kit recalled, until she suddenly found herself being dumped by her near-fiancé. Leland Hayward had spent a great deal of time in New York that year, tending to his client Edna Ferber, who had written a big hit play with George S. Kaufman called Stage Door. It starred Margaret Sullivan, an incandescent rising film star, who had already blazed through marriages to Henry Fonda and William Wyler, to say nothing of her flaming affair with Jed Harris. Well, Ferber and Kaufman were the toast of Broadway, and Margaret Sullivan was the toast of Broadway, Kate said. And Leland, well, he always liked toasts. Despite the seemingly excessive amounts of time he spent on the East Coast that year, he spoke often of his desire to marry Hepburn. During one of his absences in November 1936, Kate was dining at George Cukor's house when she heard over the radio that Leland Hayward had just married Margaret Sullivan. A telegram followed. She was distraught, until her mother made her realize that only her pride was wounded and that she was not really smarting from any genuine matrimonial plans of her own being scrubbed. Kate sent the newlyweds a congratulatory telegram, and in her next face-to-face conversation with her erstwhile agent, she learned that the bride had been pregnant at her wedding. It was really quite simple, Kate explained to me. She trapped him. Over the years, Kate spoke of Leland Hayward only in affectionate tones. He treated her similarly. His enduring feelings for her were corroborated by Hayward's third wife, the former Pamela Churchill, whom I got to know when she was later married to Ambassador Avril Harriman, a friend of Sam Goldwyn. She told me, as Kate had, that when Leland Hayward was on his deathbed, she called Hepburn and said, "He loved you the most. He's dying. Will you come to see him?" Hepburn did. Kate believed Pamela Digby Churchill Hayward Harriman had overstated her dying second husband's feelings in order to get her to make a deathbed appearance. "I think that was the secret to her success. She knew how to please men, and she would do anything for her husband," Kate explained, quickly amending, "husbands." Kate did not undervalue her relationship with Leland Hayward. She knew it had been a golden time for him as well, one with no rules and little reality. "We were two helium balloons," she said, "who popped." While she wanted to get out of Hollywood for a while, Hepburn knew that she had become a joke on Broadway. The stench from the lake still lingered. She found safe harbor in a group called the Theater Guild, one of whose founders, Teresa Helburn, wanted to star Hepburn in a production of Jane Eyre. She liked the company, and though she had some concerns about the play, she thought they could be worked out on tour. After playing Boston and Chicago, however, Hepburn and the producers found that the playwright refused to make the necessary changes. If Hepburn had learned anything in the last 2 years, it was that she should not play in anything she instinctively felt was not right. Unable to afford another fat mistake, she decided against taking the show to Broadway. Hepburn had painted herself into a corner. She had established her career in such a way that she could only appear in starring roles. But in the last year, the public had shown little interest in the leading characters she had portrayed. She had nobody but herself to blame for the flops in her past, and she had no venues or vehicles lined up for the future. Under such circumstances, most studios would have been through with her. But Pandro Berman convinced RKO to make one more attempt at reviving Hepburn's career. The studio had just purchased a property that he thought might do the trick, mostly because she would not have to carry it alone. Stage Door. For Hepburn, playing in this film was like rubbing salt into her wounds. It was bad enough being cast in the very part that had been created by Margaret Sullivan. It was worse that the play was an ensemble piece, a group of struggling actresses all living at the Footlights Club. In fact, RKO's primary purpose in making the movie was to elevate its other star, Ginger Rogers, who was on the up and up, at least as much as it was to rescue Hepburn, because I was on the down and down. The latter's role was that of Terry Randall, a snooty society girl who moves into the boarding house as a way of experiencing what it's like to be an actress, only to feel some of their suffering, thus becoming an actress along the way. Gregory LaCava, who had a drinking problem, had become that year's hottest talent because of his urbane comedy My Man Godfrey. Under his direction, RKO packed Stage Door with young talent, Lucille Ball, Eve Arden, Ann Miller, and Gail Patrick. Constance Collier played the tragicomic role of the Footlights Club den mother, a role she began to assume in Hepburn's life. Adolphe Monjou was cast as a Broadway producer, in an attempt to recreate some of the rapport he had with Hepburn in Morning Glory. The very touching Andrea Leeds, whose character's demise would allow the amateur Terry Randall to go on with the show, was borrowed from Samuel Goldwyn. Although they were all working from the basic Kaufman-Ferber text, which had been transposed to the screen by Maury Riskind and Anthony Weiler, LaCava liked to work by throwing out the script and improvising upon it every day. For the first 2 weeks of the shoot, Hepburn felt that she was just standing around, watching other actresses steal scenes. At last she went to Pan Berman and said, "What am I supposed to do? I don't know what my part is or anything about it." Berman said, "Listen, Kate, you're lucky to be playing a bit part in a successful picture. Just shut up for once and do what you're told." She knew he was right, but was not ready to acquiesce altogether. She went to LaCava, whose drinking frightened her at first, until she came to feel it was part of what made him a very talented, artistic man, and asked, "Who am I? This character, Gregory, who is she? I don't know who she's supposed to be." LaCava said, "Kate, she's the human question mark." Hepburn nodded knowingly and walked away. A moment later, she came back and asked him, "What the hell does that mean?" "Kate," he replied, "I'm damned if I know." All Kate really knew was that this was probably her last chance at maintaining her position as a star. Sufficiently humbled, she held her tongue and she held back her performance, letting those around her shine. After a few weeks of watching Hepburn's moodiness on the set, LaCava was able to answer the actress's question about her character's identity. He used Hepburn's own feelings of self-pity and exclusion to turn the character around. He enhanced her role. As Terry Randall blossoms into an inspired actress, an artist passionate enough to deliver an anthem-like curtain speech that reaches out to the others in her sorority. Kate later admitted that it had been terrifying working on a set in which so much was improvised every day, even more so because the part mirrored so much of her own life. To help Hepburn confront some of her career frustrations, LaCava decided that the play within the film, in which Terry Randall ultimately triumphs, should be Hepburn's old bête noir, The Lake. "It was a brilliant idea," Kate realized the moment he suggested it, "because it allowed me to take my most miserable moment in the theater and turn it into something fun." As a result of LaCava's instincts, audiences would forever remember Hepburn fondly, not foolishly, for uttering, "The calla lilies are in bloom again." The film was nominated for a Best Picture Academy Award and still plays like gangbusters, but it was a box office disappointment, financially successful, but only barely so. For the small profit margin, industry pundits blamed Hepburn. Believing she had at least bounced back from intense unpopularity, RKO figured the way to keep reversing the trend was to make her even bouncier. They cast her in a farce called Bringing Up Baby. Like most screwball comedies, the plot to this wise-cracking, nonsensical love story crossed the traditional lines of social, class, and sexual roles. In this case, a persistent heiress sets her madcap on a paleontologist, losing an important dinosaur bone and gaining a pet leopard named Baby along the way. Howard Hawks, who had theretofore been making his name with action-packed dramas, turned to producing as well as directing with this comedy, creating the template for most of the best pictures of his career. He liked his comedic leading men to be good-looking and good-natured, and his leading ladies to be fast-talking and slightly androgynous, able to wear the pants in the picture. He kept every scene galloping at a breakneck pace to a finish in which all the disparate pieces of the plot fall into place. "Now, I had a very strong body," Kate said of herself, "and that allowed me to play broad physical comedy very well, because I had complete confidence in my moves. And I was haughty enough in the mind of the public that it would be funny for them to see me roll in the mud or have the back of my dress ripped off." Cary Grant, who had become Hollywood's number one romantic comedy star upon the release of The Awful Truth, was an obvious choice for David Huxley, a Harold Lloyd-like professor. "We were very good together," Kate observed, "because it looked as though we were having a great deal of fun together, which we were." For all the wonderful moments in the film, including scenes with such familiar character actors as Charles Ruggles, Walter Catlett, and Fritz Feld, Bringing Up Baby fizzled at the box office. Some have argued that it came at the tail end of the screwball cycle, when a depression-weary public was tired of watching silly escapades of the rich. But several classics of the genre, in fact, would appear over the next 3 years. The Awful Truth seemed to have been the public's genuine disinterest in its star. So thought one Harry Brandt, president of the Independent Theater Owners of America. Speaking on behalf of the hundreds of businessmen whose movie houses were not part of the big studio chains, he published a list of actresses he claimed were box office poison, including Greta Garbo, Marlena Dietrich, Joan Crawford, and Katharine Hepburn. He even posted their names on big one-sheets which he had pasted around town. Those actresses didn't draw patrons into theaters, Brandt claimed, and he asked the moguls to stop hitching their vehicles to such dim stars. Nobody at RKO could disagree. Two or three big hits out of 15 pictures were not enough to warrant greater investment, and Hepburn had already survived 5 years as a star, the standard run for all but the sacred few. The studio had clearly lost interest in her, offering her an obviously inferior B picture called Mother Carey's Chickens. Refusing to pull the trigger on her own career, Hepburn bought up the rest of her RKO contract for some $200,000. That her father had been prudently investing her hefty paychecks over the years made her bold move affordable. George Cukor stepped in with an offer that even made it desirable. Columbia Studios, the poor cousin to the more established majors, had recently bought a parcel of old scripts from RKO, including the rights to Holiday, which had been filmed in 1930 with Ann Harding. Columbia head Harry Cohn hired Cukor to direct the film, figuring they could get Irene Dunne to play Linda Seaton, the spunky girl who attracts her socialite sister's impractical fiancé. Cukor vigorously argued that the roles were ideal for Hepburn and Grant. Again, Cukor's enthusiasm carried the day. "I knew that Harry Cohn was legendary as the biggest pig in town," Kate said, "but except for some coarse language, he was never anything but a gentleman with me. More than that, he took a chance on me. He knew how bad my track record had been, and he stuck by me anyway." Kate thought Holiday displayed some of her best acting, and definitely her best work with Cary Grant. After two pictures together, their acting rhythms were in complete sync with one another, and like their characters, they both found amusement in pretentiousness. "This," Kate liked to remind me, "was before Cary got too rich, while he still had to work for a living, and had fun doing it." 10 years after she had understudied Hope Williams in the role of Linda Seaton, Hepburn made the part indelibly her own, committing to celluloid a performance that is at once moving and comic, complete with her executing double somersaults with Cary Grant. Donald Ogden Stewart, who had acted in the Broadway production, had adapted the play into a fast-clipped scenario, and George Cukor made Hepburn look more glamorous than she ever had before. The film flopped. The star girded her loins to fight yet another round in Hollywood when she received a script from MGM with an offer of $10,000, a lower fee than she received when she first landed in Hollywood. She didn't need anyone to tell her it was time to get out of town. In the summer of 1938, Katharine Hepburn retreated to Fenwick with absolutely no prospect for a future in show business. "I always liked that poem by Robert Frost," Kate said, referring to the death of the hired man. "Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in." It was the only line of poetry I ever heard her recite. She knew a summer by the sea with her family and a few select friends, playing tennis and golf, would help her find her bearings. While Hartford was where she came from and New York was where she lived, Fenwick was the place that felt like home, the place she loved most, her family haven for the last 25 years. Most of the Hartford crowd had left Fenwick by mid-September, but the big wooden Hepburn house, built on brick piles, was more than a summer cottage. Kate intended to stay there indefinitely, until the afternoon of the 21st, when a hurricane, which had been threatening the eastern seaboard all week, gusted northward, heading right for the Connecticut River. Kate swam and golfed that morning, but by the afternoon the waters had turned ferocious, swamping the lawn and pounding against the house. After the chimneys toppled, the windows imploded, and a wing of the house snapped off, Kate, her mother, her brother Dick, and the cook fled to higher ground. They looked back and saw their uprooted house wash out to sea. "I think," said Kate, looking back on that entire year, "God was trying to tell me something." Chapter 6. In Bloom Again. In 1929, book editor Maxwell Perkins joined Ernest Hemingway in Key West for 8 days of fishing. Toward the end of his visit, The editor looked at the panorama of life there in the Gulf Stream and asked his author why he didn't write about it. Just then a big, clumsy bird flew by. "I might someday, but not yet," Hemingway said. "Take that pelican. I don't know yet what he is in the scheme of things here." During the 10 years I worked on my biography of Samuel Goldwyn, I thought of Katharine Hepburn as my pelican, this unusual creature that was so much a part of the Hollywood landscape, but somehow always flapping above it. I used my understanding of her role in the motion picture community to measure when I was ready to stop researching and begin writing. She proved to be a good yardstick. Although she never worked with Samuel Goldwyn, her name surfaced practically every day, either in a document or during an interview. In fact, she provided a most pungent comment about Sam and Frances Goldwyn herself, observing, "You always knew where your career in Hollywood stood by where you sat at the Goldwyn table." For somebody who considered herself a Hollywood outsider, she left lasting impressions there over 6 decades. Lucille Ball, who broke in as a Goldwyn girl before attaining co-star status in Stage Door, remembered Hepburn with adoration and admiration. "We all wanted to be Catherine," she said, thinking mostly of Kate's self-assuredness. "Even Ginger. No, especially Ginger." Joan Bennett from Little Women, who had first worked for Goldwyn as a child in silent pictures, said, "Kate was always the star. There was no mistake about that. But she was always busy giving everybody advice. But it was good advice." Joseph L. Mankiewicz, who directed Guys and Dolls for Goldwyn, was talking about Hollywood's bringing out the best and the worst in people when her name entered the conversation. "You know," he said, to illustrate his point, "Katharine Hepburn actually spat at me." As I was wondering whether he was describing the worst being brought out in him or in her, he sheepishly added, "I had it coming." By the time I met Edith Mayer Goetz, she had not spoken to her sister Irene Selznick for about a decade. "We fought over who was top dog, socially, in town," said Irene dismissively, from which I was to infer that there had been 70 years of sibling rivalry, the causes of which Edie was too superficial to understand. When I interviewed her, Mrs. Goetz brought up Hepburn's name, bragging how she and Spencer Tracy used to come to her magnificent art-filled house in Holmby Hills. "Oh, the vulgarity," Irene groaned at the boast when I told her, "and the falsity." I was surprised myself at the claim, as Kate had told me she and Tracy saw few people as a couple, and the Goetzes were hardly on their social roster. I asked Mrs. Goetz about their friendship. Without missing a beat, Edie produced the guest lists of every one of her fabled parties, and there indeed were Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy attending a party for the newlyweds Frank Sinatra and Mia Farrow. "I never really cared for Frank," Kate later told me, "and you must never ask me about the girl." I later learned that she considered Mia Farrow's father, an Australian-born writer-director named John, so depraved that there was no way that girl could have any moral structure to her life. But Spence and Frank were friends, and he liked to go out, and so we went to that wedding party in separate cars. But honestly, I don't remember seeing the inside of the Goetz house more than twice in my life. As I was leaving my interview with Mrs. Goetz, her butler, whom she proudly told me she had lured from Buckingham Palace, had evidently fallen asleep on the job and was nowhere to be found. My hostess herself walked me to the door, where I had trouble figuring out the unusual handle. "Mrs. Goetz," I said after fumbling for a few seconds, "can you help me get this door open?" "No," she replied. "Doors have always been opened for me." Irene howled about that for years and trotted out the line almost every time I left her apartment. Of course, no conversation with George Cukor was complete without some reference to Kate, with whom I think he had more fun than anybody on earth. And yet Kate had always felt she played second fiddle in his life. They worked together nearly a dozen times. He was her landlord for years, and she was the only person licensed to walk into his house unannounced, whether it was a weeknight dinner party. "He always seated me below the salt, usually at the very end of the table with Irene Selznick. Saturday garden parties where, decade after decade, the other great actresses could let down their hair and pick up acting pointers, or even the private Sunday pool parties for men only. But Kate knew the only leading lady in George's life was Sam Goldwyn's wife, Frances. As theater novices in upstate New York, they had lived in the same boarding houses and had become instant friends. Something of an outcast, he found a great admirer in Frances, who appreciated this angel, a generous soul who took her under wing and shared his wealth of artistic ideas. For his part, he enjoyed having a Galatea who was such a quick and appreciative study, an icy beauty. Their friendship deepened over the next 50 years, during which time George's harem, as Francis Goldwyn often referred to his coterie of famous Hollywood women, widened. Even with Cukor's constant devotion, from the 1930s on, Francis found herself admitting, "I'm really his second favorite. Kate's his first." In her mind, she invented a rivalry for his affections. Kate found such talk ludicrous. "George and I adored each other," she said, "but whenever things got personal, I'm sure he went to Francis first. He and I had a wonderful rapport, but they had a history together, trust, a deep trust." While Mrs. Goldwyn and Miss Hepburn never became friends, they were always cordial with each other. Upon Sam Goldwyn's death in 1974, his son learned that there was an extra crypt in the family plot for George Cukor. When the younger Goldwyn raised this subject with his mother, Francis laughed gently and said, "Well, at least Kate won't get him there." In her first 15 months of widowhood, Francis suffered from a fast metastasizing cancer of the nose and trachea which invaded her brain. Kate fondly remembered the special attention George paid to her during that period. She entertained them for dinner on several occasions, and every time the weakening Francis's nose would run or a little bit of food would dribble from the side of her mouth, George was there to dab her face with a handkerchief. Francis died in 1976 and was buried alongside her husband. On January 24, 1983, just a few months before I had met Hepburn, George Cukor died at the age of 83. Kate had no idea that in the hours after his death, Samuel Goldwyn Jr. had immediately informed Cukor's executor that Francis had prearranged for George's burial. The executor found as much in Cukor's will, and those wishes were observed. He rests eternally alongside the Goldwyns and Francis's batty mother in the unmarked little garden of Constancy, a large private plot within the walled Garden of Honor, which sits behind two locked iron doors, accessible only by private key, at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Glendale. The day I researched the site for my Goldwyn biography, I noticed the grave of Spencer Tracy only a few gardens away. "How fascinating," Kate said upon learning this information. "I never knew, and I've never been there. You say you need a key to get in. How extraordinary." Then, with the catchphrase she always used to express that there was nothing more to say on a subject, she added a world-weary, "Life, life, life." Immediately after the hurricane of 1938 had blown past Fenwick, the Hepburns began reconstructing their house. "We learned a lesson from the three little pigs," said Kate, "and built with brick this time." Choosing the same site, they raised the property by 3 feet. With the passage of another half-century, Kate realized they had woefully undercalculated as future storms periodically pushed waters through the ground floor of the house and washed away a little more of their beach each year. In the days following the great hurricane, Kate combed the sand and recovered a dozen of her mother's silver place settings and her complete tea service. After all the upheavals of 1938, two other important pieces of her life remained. For almost 3 years, Katharine Hepburn had been keeping company with another beau, far and away the most exciting and complicated of them all, Howard Hughes. The heir to the Hughes Tool Company, a motion picture producer, a celebrated aviator, and a notorious playboy, the tall and handsome Hughes had been smitten with Katharine Hepburn since she first appeared on the screen. Orphaned as a teenager, he followed his uncle Rupert, a hugely successful writer for Goldwyn, to Hollywood. He dallied with movie stars, falling in love with the silent screen queen Billy Dove, who was 5 years his senior. By 1935, however, his eyes had turned toward Katharine Hepburn. In early 1936, while she was filming Sylvia Scarlett just above Trancas Beach, Kate and George Cukor used to have their staffs prepare picnic lunches for them and selected members of the cast and crew. One day during their break, a small plane circled overhead, zeroed in on them, then landed but a short walk away. Kate suddenly noticed Cary Grant looking sheepish. "That's my friend Howard Hughes," he said. Hepburn had heard that Hughes was eager to meet her, and she was put out with her friend Cary for springing their introduction on her this way. I'm sure the boys thought, oh, this will be a cute meet, all very romantic and irresistible. But Howard and I met, and we shook hands, and it was all too self-conscious, so staged, false. There was nothing spontaneous about it. I was so angry I ate my lunch without looking at either one of them. A short time later, Kate was playing golf at the Bel Air Country Club when Hughes performed a similar stunt, this time landing right on the 7th fairway. Out of his plane he hopped, carrying a golf bag, Kate said, and he finished the 9 with my instructor and me. And he was quite a good golfer, but what gall! But you see, Howard was a man of action and not words, and I think this was simply the best way he could think of expressing his feelings. Hughes was a practical dreamer, prone to planned impulsiveness. He liked to act on the spur of the moment, but only after he had thought through the details of his actions. In this instance, he suddenly found his plane sitting in the middle of a golf course, which had provided enough room to land, but not enough to take off again. Hughes had thought that through as well. There were few problems a little of his money could not solve, Kate pointed out. He simply had some mechanics come and dismantle the plane and cart it off. As for getting himself home, he just assumed I'd cart him off. What gall! God, he was exciting. Great fun. Hepburn gave Hughes a lift to the Beverly Hills Hotel. In almost no time, she learned that after having produced Hell's Angels, The Front Page, and Scarface, he had really no great passion for picture-making. He was a brilliant man, said Kate, and not as silly as that. But he did have a passion for movie stars. In 1936, when Hepburn toured with Jane Eyre, Hughes would suddenly arrive before her performances in Boston, and then Chicago. In time, she got caught up in the rush and surrendered. I think we were both thrill-seekers, you might say, Kate suggested. I always liked to go, 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 and Howard was always up for adventure. Now, he always liked to think things through, and I was always more instinctive, but we had a lot of common interests. Not the least of these interests, Kate admitted, was courting fame. She said, when I met Howard, the man he admired most was Lindbergh, not just for what he accomplished, but for all the acclaim. Howard was determined to set new records in aviation, but I think that was largely because he really wanted the big parade. And you see, I too wanted to be a star, desperately wanted to be a star. Paradoxically, neither Hepburn nor Hughes liked crowds. In fact, they expended much of their energy evading the public, craving privacy. They were always on the run from newsreel cameras and popping flashbulbs. I think that was part of the fun for the two of us, said Kate, that we could indulge in this game with the public together. It was definitely more fun together, and in a way that was the basis for our relationship. We were both famous and came from comfortable backgrounds. We understood each other. I think we felt we were right for each other, and secretly I think we felt the public thought we were somehow right for each other. Going around together enhanced both our reputations. But there was a basic problem. I am, by nature, a loner. And that's not a very good basis for a serious relationship. But it was obviously pleasurable for these two enormously attractive people. I never heard Kate talk about anybody with more of a glint in her eye, making it very clear that this was the lustiest relationship of her life. It was not the most profound, but it was definitely the one built most on plain physical attraction. Eros. During their time together, Kate increasingly found Hughes to be a loner as well. Losing his parents as a teenager was one apparent cause for that, but she believed there was another equally strong. People simply don't understand how deaf Howard was, she explained, from the age of 15. And I think this contributed to everything that happened to him in his life, for both good and bad. It made him terribly detached and a real self-starter. But it also started him down an endlessly lonely path, really cut off from people. In my experience, Kate always expected one to speak clearly, concisely, and audibly. If one rambled on too long in her presence, she'd interrupt to ask, "What's your point?" If one mumbled, she'd interrupt to say, "I don't understand you," or "Speak up, I can't hear you." That, she said, was something Howard Hughes never did, and that failure condemned him to isolation. The deafness, she explained, was not his greatest weakness, so much as his failing to acknowledge it in public. thus forcing him to miss parts of conversations and often to misunderstand those parts that he had heard. Quite simply, Kate said, it ruined his life. I mean, what does that do to a person? She wondered out loud decades later. It forced Howard into a world of his own, one in which he dwelt more and more on himself, becoming obsessed with the details of his own life. From the time we first started going around, he was concerned about germs and disease. He washed his hands a lot, and he took a lot of showers, and nobody else was allowed to use the same shower. It had to be disinfected after each use. Now, a lot of that just makes common sense. Doctors tell us today that it's good to wash your hands a lot to keep them from spreading germs, and I always took a lot of showers. But in his loneliness, and I think there was a well of loneliness within Howard, he gradually crossed the line, that line between peculiar behavior and what I guess one would call neurotic. Then you must remember his upbringing, which left him virtually alone in the world. And then years later, you know, he suffered terribly after an airplane accident and got hooked on hard stuff, morphine. And then again, there was his deafness. I know he heard ringing in his ears, and I'm sure he heard voices in his head for years and years. So you see, we really are extremely fragile creatures. Because here was this absolutely brilliant man, I mean brilliant in everything he attempted, and yet he was never more than an inch away from crossing that line into the land of cuckoo. Their time alone together was, for the most part, a great romp. They were, Kate insisted, in love, at least with the idea of each other. They flew together, with Hepburn once taking off in a seaplane under the 59th Street Bridge. They skinny-dipped in the Long Island Sound, diving off the wing of his plane. They golfed in Fenwick, where they often were joined by Luddy, who always seemed to have a movie camera in his hand. Once, while golfing with Kate and her father, Hughes objected not only to Luddy's omnipresence, but to the invasion of his privacy with the camera clicking away. Howard, Dr. Hepburn interjected, Luddy has been taking pictures of all of us for years before you got here, and he'll be taking them years after you've gone. He's part of this family. Now drive. Hughes never felt comfortable with the Hepburns, or, Kate pointed out, with anyone else's family. It's hard to understand what it's like to be really close to your family, Kate said, unless you come from a close family yourself. You get that, she said to me, knowing I was close to my parents and three brothers, and I get that, but Howard never did. Left to themselves, Hepburn and Hughes played house, sharing some tranquil domesticity in his large Monterey-style house on Muirfield Road, which bordered the Wilshire Country Club. Golf balls, Kate said, used to fly into our backyard. On quiet days, which they both cherished, they'd crawl under the fence and play nine holes there themselves. Meantime, they pursued their careers, Hughes becoming increasingly potent in aviation, just as Hepburn was becoming poison in the movie business. The more time Hughes spent with Hepburn, the more he wanted to marry her. Thinking that her career slump might make her more open to the suggestion of sharing their lives, he proposed to her, more than once. Hughes had read her wrong. The downturn in Hepburn's career only made her more ferocious about her independence, more determined to prove herself on her own. Now look, Kate said to me one afternoon, I think Howard was really in love with me, and I really loved being with him. But honestly, what kind of marriage would that have been? I was trying to put my career together again. I was thinking all about me, me, me. And even if my career had been in another place, I don't think I ever would have married him. I was always straight with him about that, but Howard just didn't hear me. Maybe, I suggested, he couldn't hear you. Howard heard, she amended, what he wanted to hear. She had already refused Hughes's offer when he took off on an around-the-world flight in July 1938, a record-setting journey of 3 days, 19 hours, and 17 minutes, for which he received his ticker tape parade through Broadway's Canyon of Heroes. The tabloid-reading public buzzed nonetheless about his pending nuptials to Katharine Hepburn. In fact, Hepburn was entertaining another suitor that summer, who arrived with an offer far more tempting than marriage. Her old friend Philip Barry, whose career was in a slump of its own, called from Maine one day and invited himself to tea. I was surprised, Kate said, because the last time I had heard from him was when he got me fired from the Animal Kingdom as the understudy, 8 years prior. On the pier at Fenwick, he described two stories he was hatching, plays in which he kept hearing her voice. One was a father-daughter story called Second Threshold. The other centered on a society wedding on Philadelphia's main line, where a rich young divorcee was about to marry again, this time to a boring, self-made man who was marrying up. The proceedings would be disrupted by her raffish first husband, who lingers in her life, Luddy-like. Looking out at some sailboats on the sea, Barry and Hepburn talked about the heroine, who in her first marriage had proved not to be yar, a nautical term meaning easy to handle, quick to the helm. Kate voted for the latter play because it sounded more fun. Within weeks, she was reading pages of the first act of the Philadelphia story. Then came the hurricane of 1938. Hughes sent a pilot to Fenwick that week with huge bottles of fresh water. Upon hearing about this life preserver Barry was throwing to her, he also gave her some advice: to purchase the motion picture rights of this new play even before it opened. If the Philadelphia story was that good, he reasoned, it could prove to be her vehicle back to Hollywood, and if it did not pan out, an investment this early in the game would hardly be that great. Hughes went so far as to buy the rights as a present for her, withholding a percentage as an investment for himself. While he would soon move on to business ventures and romantic adventures with other partners, Hepburn and Hughes would forever be bound by their joint interest in the Philadelphia story. While Barry was finishing his play, Hepburn set about getting it produced. She felt beholden to the Theatre Guild because they had let her both star in and leave its production of Jane Eyre. Barry had had a bad experience with the Guild and wanted to go elsewhere, and neither he nor Hepburn knew that the company was then practically bankrupt. Meantime, the Theatre Guild didn't know that Hepburn had been banished from Hollywood. "We were all washed up," said Kate, "and nobody knew the whole truth about the other. Hopeless." In the end, they all came together, as Hughes and Hepburn each put up a quarter of the production costs, thus becoming profit participants. Under the direction of Robert B. Sinclair, who had recently triumphed with Claire Booth Luce's The Women, they assembled a remarkable supporting cast, while Barry struggled with the play's final act. From the Mercury Theater, they grabbed Joseph Cotton to play C.K. Dexter Haven, Tracy's first husband, and from A Woman Rebels, Kate remembered the virile performance of her co-star Van Heflin, who was cast as Macaulay Connor, the cynical reporter assigned to cover the Philadelphia wedding. Shirley Booth was cast as his photographer sidekick, and Kate thought her performance was brilliant because she found much more in the part than had appeared on the page. They lucked out further with the discovery of a remarkable 10-year-old named Lenore Lonergan. "A real caution," said Kate, to play the heroine Tracy Lord's wise-cracking kid sister. After one of the out-of-town performances, Lawrence Langner came backstage and said, "Kate, I think the girl is copying you. All your movements, your gestures, your delivery." "You've got it all wrong," she told Langner, dead serious. "I'm copying her." At last, Barry finished the play, and from that moment on, Kate said, "It smelled like a hit." Pleasing her as much as the elegance of the comedy, there was nothing cheap about any of it, just real humor that grew from the character, was the construction of the drama. "People don't realize how ingenious Phil Barry's play is," she said, "how he drew three different men, all from different social positions, and up until the last moment of the play, there's a good argument to be made for Tracy to marry any one of them. In the end, I think the play draws the truest and most romantic conclusion." As if that were not enough, the entire work was tailored to showcase Hepburn, allowing her to rattle off passages of witty dialogue while men fell at her feet. "An actress doesn't get many of those in a lifetime," Kate said of her role in the Philadelphia story, "and she doesn't need many." Yet for another reason, the timing of Tracy Lord's entrance into Hepburn's life could not have been timelier. Like most film actresses in the late 30s, she felt she had just lost the role of a lifetime, Scarlett O'Hara, a role that she thought for a moment might be hers. A few years earlier, Katharine Hepburn believed she had been the first actress to receive a set of galley proofs of Gone with the Wind at the behest of the author, Margaret Mitchell. She adored the part and immediately saw herself in it. Pandro Berman's assistant read the book for him, and after hearing the story, Berman felt Hepburn was wrong for Scarlett. RKO passed on bidding for the project, though they could probably have bought the film rights for a song. A few weekends later, Hepburn and George Cukor went to visit Myron Selznick at his vacation house at Lake Arrowhead. David Selznick answered the door, carrying the galleys of the book. Hepburn said to him, "Don't bother reading it, David. Just buy it. It's sensational." Selznick didn't need convincing.